You're listening to Red Nation Online.
You're listening to the North of 49 Soccer Podcast. Interviews, analysis, and discussion about Canadian soccer with hosts Chris Williams and Steve Watcher.
All right, here we are back with Chris Williams on the North of 49 podcast, episode 2. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It was a big weekend for Canadian soccer fans, and it's hard to try and keep up, but nevertheless, an exciting time in Canadian soccer.
Yeah, definitely an exciting time. We'll get to discussing the Montreal game in particular later, and also have an interview with the Montreal Impact's Greg Sutton coming up a little bit later in the podcast as well. But at first, I actually wanted to ask you, Chris, if you might be able to pick my lottery numbers this week.
Yeah, I think I should give it a try. I think maybe I should start playing the lottery as well, because it seems that I've been making the right decisions in terms of my selections for TFC anyway. So.
Yes, you were right and I was wrong. I'm putting that on the record right now. Not only did you predict the TFC win, but you predicted the score, and you even predicted Mr. Ryan Johnson coming through with another big game. So kudos to you for that. And at some point during this podcast, I'm going to put you on the spot and try and get another prediction out of you.
Look forward to it.
But why don't we just start off by talking about that game, the Los Angeles Galaxy game. You know, a huge victory for TFC and for the organization, the first Canadian team now to move to the semifinals of the CONCACAF Champions League. And you know, as you predicted, Ryan Johnson was phenomenal in that game again, with a goal and an assist, and you know, he just seemed to be everywhere, whether he's knocking goals in with his head or with his foot. You know, he just seems to be the man right now. The question I have about Ryan Johnson with you is, I don't think there's any doubt about his quality and how well he fits within the system. It is, do you think he can keep it up for a whole season with the way he's been playing for the first three games?
Yeah, there's a number of points there that you made, and the question, I'll get to Ryan Johnson in a little bit. He definitely has broad shoulders right now, and well, let's hope that he can continue that. But a first point to make is that the CONCACAF game in L.A., in Los Angeles, it had a definite CONCACAF feel, just the field and the fan support from the Los Angeles Galaxy. I believe there was a cap on the attendance that was mentioned in the broadcast, and it didn't obviously have the same feel as at the Rogers Center. And again, kudos to MLSC and Toronto FC fans for supporting and creating that atmosphere. What a fantastic atmosphere. Again, just have to mention that. But Toronto FC definitely, they looked out of sorts in the beginning. I was thinking, you know, maybe my prediction was going to be a little off, but they stuck through it. They definitely withheld that pressure that they were faced from the Galaxy. Beckham and crew were, you know, giving them quite a bit of pressure in the beginning, spraying balls out wide. And I thought, well, Toronto FC, if they could just withstand this pressure and get a few chances, they could gain some momentum. And I think they did so. There were periods where Sulzma looked dangerous, Eckersley playing him in early, and I think that's key for Sulzma. Once he gets in early and he's facing his fullback, he can run at him with his qualities. And you saw with Ryan Johnson, definitely, as I mentioned last week's podcast, once he's in an area, an attacking area, and he can face that defender and run at them with his pace and his attributes, I don't think there are too many defenders that want to come up against him. I know when I was playing, I wouldn't want to come up against a player like Ryan Johnson. He can beat you to the left or to the right. He can use both feet quite well, and as he's showing in recent games, he can use his head. So kudos to Ryan Johnson and to Nick Sulzma. Again, I quite like Sulzma. He seems to be effective, but once I think he's played in early, as I mentioned, then he can be really effective. Cooper Mins didn't look to be quite on his game, but I think he's a presence, and you have to mention him. You also have to be aware of him as a defender, because he's a big, strong presence. And once he's played in early, again, I think it's key for Toronto. Once they play the ball in from Frings or Julian de Guzman early into Cooper Mins or out wide, I think Toronto FC can really be effective.
Yeah, Sulzma is an interesting player, and you know, Ryan Johnson was the clear man of the match, but I think if there was sort of a Robin to his Batman in that game, it was definitely Nick Sulzma. And certainly he came through with the winning goal and also set up the first goal. Interesting thing about Sosma, I remember during the offseason, you know, reading a number of publications, and, you know, there were a lot of people calling for, you know, him to be exposed in the expansion draft, or, you know, saying that the team should bring another player in for that that right-sided position who's a little bit quicker. Certainly Sulzman's not, you know, not the fastest player. I don't think he's slow by any stretch, but you know, he just seems to be one of those guys who's effective, and you know, I guess all those years in playing in the Netherlands just make him a real good fit for Aaron Winter's system.
Yes, he's deceivingly quick, Sulzma. He's a runner. I know from the Whitecaps players, they've always said that Nick Sulzma is a deceiving player because he does like to run at you. And deceivingly quick, as I said. But yeah, Nick Sulzma, definitely Robin to Ryan Johnson. And to go back to your question, Ryan Johnson, can he handle that pressure and continue that and be consistent all season long? I'm not too sure. He needs a supporting cast, and hopefully Toronto FC can provide that for him, because he definitely has the attributes and the assets to do so, but he needs support along the way.
Now, another player who stood out in that game, the winning game against Los Angeles, was the starting keeper, who was a little bit of a surprise, actually, for me, in that he got the start, and that was Milos Kosic. A number of great stops, and, you know, you had to figure that TFC wasn't going through without his performance. So, the way he performed there, and he did get the start in the next game against Seattle, I just want to throw it out there. At this point in time, you know, if you were in Aaron Winter's shoes, who's your starting keeper, Stefan Fry or Milos Kosic?
Great question, and putting me on the spot there. I would pick Milos Kosic. He came up big for Toronto FC in the CONCACAF match, and to be honest, if he didn't make those key saves, Toronto FC would not be winners of that match, and they wouldn't be going through to the next round. So Milos Kosic right now, he has confidence. You could see it in his play. I would definitely start him. Stefan Fry, you know what, that's a competition between those two, and it's a healthy competition, and I think Toronto FC is in a great position with those two goalkeepers, because they can, either one of those goalkeepers can be starters on an MLS club. So I think that's a healthy competition and a great situation for Toronto FC.
So congratulations to Toronto FC, a huge result, a huge achievement, but in the spirit of what have you done for me lately, I think now we need to look forward and, you know, look at their next opponent, you know, Santos Laguna. And both of you, I believe, both you and I at least caught a bit of their match on Wednesday night as well, in which they pretty much decimated the Seattle Sounders 6-1, playing in Mexico. So, you know, an imposing opponent. Chris, I'm going to put it right out there. Does TFC have any hope in the next round? And, you know, what do they need to do to be able to compete with a team like that?
Well, this is a lottery ticket that I probably won't play, just because I think TFC needs to gain some momentum here. And their last result against Seattle, I believe we're going to get to that, and they didn't do so well in terms of the performance. They need to gain some momentum before playing that next CONCACAF Champions League match, and I'm not too sure how it's going to go for them. It's a tough environment going down to Mexico, as many Canadians know. Whenever you play in Canada, just the altitude, the atmosphere, and if you think that the Rogers Centre has an atmosphere and crowd support, I mean, wait till they get to Mexico. I think Toronto FC can use that to their advantage as well. It's not a negative, but it's definitely their backs are going to be up against the wall, and they have to get the tactics right. Aaron Winter has to play his best players. He can't afford to have any players sulking for not playing, and they have to get that right, and hopefully they will. So leading up to that game, I think it's about confidence. I think they definitely have to get a victory in Toronto, because their backs will be up against the wall in Mexico. I wish them all the best, and I hope they can pull out a victory.
Okay, well, let's talk about that game versus Seattle. It was Toronto's first MLS game this year, and, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a team suffered a little bit of a hangover and maybe was a little bit overconfident or even a little bit, you know, mentally exhausted after what they went through in the, you know, the two-leg tie versus the Galaxy. So, you know, what were your general thoughts on that game? It was certainly an interesting lineup that Aaron Winter put out there.
Yes, it was an interesting lineup, and when I saw it, I was thinking, are there some injuries? You know, something's up. Maybe, and I guess you could look at it in two ways. Maybe Aaron Winter is resting his players. Kuberman didn't start. Julian de Guzman didn't start. wasn't in the lineup. So I have to say that maybe he was resting those players. Maybe there is a little bit of a hangover. They're just struggling with little injuries. I hope that's the case, because those are the players that you need to be in your lineup, game in, game out, game out. And they weren't there. So it was disappointing to see that. And they struggled a little bit. The fluidity of play that Toronto FC had was lacking, and you could see the Seattle Sounders. They were mobile, agile, and playing those through balls. And with that Toronto FC back line, they were playing quite high, and it wasn't effective for them. And you could see just the through balls that were played from the Seattle midfield. They were tormenting the TFC defense, and it didn't look good. So I'm not too sure why Aaron Vinter employed that lineup. I hope there's a method to his madness. And let's just hope that going forward, Toronto FC can play their best players, because you need your 2D players, your 3D DP players on the field game in, game out, and your best lineup game in, game out. So let's hope they can move forward and do so.
Let's talk about that high line. There's been a lot of chatter about that, you know, through these first three games, you know, and how both Los Angeles and Seattle were really focused on trying to beat that high line. I know that's a component of the style of play that Vinter wants to have TFC play at this year, in terms of, you know, having that back line pushing forward and supporting the attack and whatnot. But you know, from what you've seen through three games, are they going to be able to continue with that approach?
I'm going to say that they're going to be in trouble if they continue that approach, just because you're incorporating new players at the back. There needs to be consistency, communication, and I don't think Toronto FC has that down pack just yet. I think that that's a season-long venture, and you need to invest in that, you know, during training, during matches, and I believe that with that type of high line, Toronto FC could see some goals against them that they usually you wouldn't give up, you know, with a normal line of defense. So I hope that they work on that during training. I'm sure Aaron Vinter must be, you know, pulling out his hair, or what's left of it anyways, and just making sure that they get that right, because it's going to be quite difficult to keep that high line. And when you play a high line like that, I know from playing at the back, you need to have some pace to your defenders and your center back. So when you're running up against, you know, players like Landon Donovan, who's quite pacey, and players like Niasse from Montreal, you need players that can run with them, and if you don't have those players at your disposal, then you could be in trouble. So they have to get that right and very accurate. There's no, you know, there's no hemming and hawing, no doubt about it. You have to get that right if you're going to play that high line.
Now, obviously, the result wasn't what Toronto FC fans wanted to see, but you know, depending on how his injury pans out, if Torsten Frings is out of the lineup for any length of time, it could be much more catastrophic than simply the loss of 3 points. You know, he's got to be the most important player on the team, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on TFC's, you know, chances without him in the lineup.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think Toronto FC could be in trouble if it's a long-term injury. Torsten Frings is definitely the leader of that group there, and without him, you could see, as he goes out of that lineup, you could see just a little bit of chaos ensues, and he definitely commands order amongst the back line there, and throughout the team, he's the spine of that team. So I hope for TFC's sake and the fans' sake here in Toronto that Torsten Frings isn't gone for a long time. I think, again, it goes back to playing your best players, and other players need to step up. Obviously, Toronto FC has Julian de Guzman, Terry Dunfield, the Canadian international, is there, and I think that's a role that he could, you know, possibly take over and fill a void once Torsten Frings is out. So let's hope that the injury isn't a long-term and short-term injury, and he can get back as soon as possible.
One thing that really stood out for me from a defensive standpoint in that game was the lack of João Plata and Ashton Morgan. And, you know, you might find that a little bit funny, but I'm referring to their absence in the sense of, you know, the best defense being a good offense. And, you know, with their pace missing down the flanks there, it seemed like, you know, TFC were really struggling, and it was just a constant deluge of Seattle Sounder players coming at them. You know, even looking at that win against the Galaxy, you know, at the Home Depot Center, you know, I was very impressed with Morgan in terms of, you know, how he brought the ball down, seemed to continually put the pressure on some tired Galaxy players, and it also ate a lot of clock. So, you know, I think those two players pretty much have to be in the lineup all the time for both defensive and offensive purposes.
Yeah, I would agree. Modern-day football, make no mistake about it, is about pace, it's about strength, it's about creativity. And if Toronto FC does not have those type of players in their lineup, then they're going to struggle. Because as I remember going back to the Seattle game, they did lack creativity. And I remember seeing Seattle just constantly playing through balls, and Toronto FC was their backs were against the wall again. And I just think you have to have players that can affect change in the game. And it's at key moments. You talk about the time, the clock. Yes, it's important, but it has to be consistently through the game. And I think once the opposition feels that there's no threat in behind them, no threat in midfield in terms of pacey players in and around that, those areas, those threatening areas, then, you know what, they're going to feel a little bit more confident. From a player standpoint, I remember, if a player is running in behind me because they're pacey, I'm going to be on my heels, I'm going to be worried about them, and I'm not going to want to defend that player. And I don't know, you just mentioned Joao Plata, so if he's the left midfielder and Ashton Morgan's bringing the ball forward, you know, those are two players that are quite athletic, and you're going to be nervous, you're going to be worried about them. So those types of players need to be in the lineup, and players who don't have that type of agility and creativity, then, you know, you have to find a position for them that they can be effective and make an impact.
Given that the game was in Seattle, you know, I don't believe any of the Toronto beat writers were in attendance and peppering Vinter with questions about his lineup after the fact. So we're not really sure if players picked up a knock or whatnot. But, you know, we'll keep an eye out there and see if there was a legitimate reason why he made the lineup decisions that he did. Of course, he is the manager, and he, you know, the buck stops with him. One thing that's positive about a positive for TFC, and you've mentioned him already, is Danny Kuvermans. And I think just the fact that you know, the team has defeated the Los Angeles Galaxy and moved on and played their first MLS game. You know, they've got a win, they've got a very tight draw, and then a loss. All of those have come without Danny Kuvermans really being in form and scoring a goal. You know, this is a guy who was on probably a more than a goal a game pace at the end of last season. So it looks like the team does have, you know, something to look forward to in terms of him bringing, you know, a bit of a lift to the offense once he does get match fit and back to that form from last season.
Yes, Danny Kuvermans definitely a pivotal figure in that lineup, in that locker room. And he's not firing on all cylinders just yet. I think that's a positive. I think he will only get better. He will only improve. He is TFC's goal-scoring leader. And I think, again, his presence, you cannot ignore that. So let's hope that he can stay in the lineup. TFC needs to get their back line, their defensive, you know, strengthen those defensive capabilities and get back some players like Adrian Kahn back in the lineup. And that's another leader there in the locker room. But Danny Kuvermans is definitely a player that TFC needs and needs to depend on. And I think TFC's attack is quite formidable, sorry about that. I think that, you know, with Soelsma, with Ryan Johnson, you have some weapons there. You have some threats and Joao Plata. So I think they're in business once everybody's healthy. And, yeah, I look forward to them doing well. Aaron Vinter, I don't want to question him in terms of, you know, the buck stops with him. He is the manager. And let's hope there's a method to his madness. And he wants to maximize every single player in that locker room, and hopefully he does that. And he is the boss, so hopefully he will do so. And he's definitely accountable for his decisions, and I don't think he has any problems with that. So I don't think he's too worried about the Toronto media getting on him.
All right. Well, we'll see how Toronto FC does next week in their home opener, and we'll also look out for any medical reports on Torsten Frings and hope that that was just a precaution to take him out of that game. Now, as we did last week with Julian de Guzman, we have another guest that we interviewed for this week's podcast. This week, you and I interviewed Montreal Impact keeper and Canadian international Greg Sutton. We spoke to him just prior to Montreal's home opener, and given his considerable history with Montreal, Toronto FC, the MLS, and the Canadian national team, I think it's a pretty interesting interview. Here's our chat with Greg Sutton.
Greg, in a way, you have come full circle back to Montreal, where you previously played from 2001 to 2006. How has the organization changed and evolved since your stint with the team?
It's been a work in progress, I think, from, you know, the beginning of my tenure when I joined the club in 2001 to today. I mean, there's been evolving and in numerous ways, but I think all in very positive ways. You know, I think the person that's, you know, I have to give credit to is Joey Saputo. I think he's put his backing behind it, and you know, he put his faith in the city of Montreal that they would support the club. And, you know, the early stages of 2000, I think there were maybe, you know, a handful of people in the stands watching Impact games until, you know, and now and today, if you look at tomorrow's game, you know, their first MLS game at home. And, you know, they're going to pack the Big O with probably close to 60,000 people. So, you know, it's been a great progression for the club. And you know, I think a lot of credit goes to the people that are in charge of the management group. They've done a great job in putting the right pieces on the field and in the office. And you know, it's going to continue to grow now that they've joined Major League Soccer. And you know, that they understand it's a whole new level, and there's a lot that comes with joining a league like MLS, and I think they've done their homework, and they're going to be prepared to move forward.
Greg, you were very successful during your previous time with the Impact, winning awards and allowing the fewest goals in the league. Is there a particular comfort factor now that you're back with Montreal?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, obviously, from you know, a living standpoint, I'm used to the surroundings. Lived in the city long enough to know how to get around, and having that comfortability is important. You know, from a family's perspective, and you know, it obviously makes it a lot easier. You know, going into training every day and you know, focusing on what needs to be done on the field. And so, you know, and again, you know, having familiar surroundings is always comforting. And so, you know, there is that comfortability that you know, really does. Does come through, you know, now that I'm back, and you know, hopefully that'll help me, you know, continue to improve as a player here in Montreal this year and in years to come.
Greg, you and I played together in Montreal, winning a championship back in 2004. How is the mood and sense of excitement in the city now that the club has moved up to MLS?
Yeah, no, it's really exciting. I mean, I remember Chris Lane whipping in balls from the right side there, eh? and you know, those were good days, but I think now now the city is looking for more, and you know, hopefully we can, you know, have some more success in going along here. And obviously, it's transitioning to Major League Soccer it's not going to be easy. You know, we understand that, but at the same time, you know, we have lofty goals, and that's, you know, to win a championship as soon as possible. So, but I, you know, that's why I think this has. Has done well as it has. They brought in players, you know, like yourself, Chris, and guys that are winners and guys that, you know, compete on the field and play hard every day. And, you know, if you have those type of players, well, you're going to have success on the field. So, you know, the city is looking for that again. And, you know, we hope to bring them to them as fast as possible.
Greg, this year will be the second time that you've played on an MLS expansion team. What do you think the Impact need to do in order to not repeat the struggles that Toronto FC endured in their early years?
Yeah, well, I think they've already accomplished some things that we struggled with in Toronto, and that's, you know, putting together a veteran, you know, leader, MLS talented group. I mean, a lot of guys we had in Toronto had never played in Major League Soccer, and, you know, and that's a factor because it takes some time to adjust to the league. You know, but we've got a lot of MLS experience on this team going forward. You know, I think we're as a team, as a whole, you know, team structure, I think we're a lot more organized than we were in 2000 with Toronto, and that pays dividends in this league, you know, for sure. And Jesse Marsh is, you know, he's got the type of, you know, persona to keep guys on a consistent level basis, not get too high, not get too low, and you know, not, you know, when things are going bad, be able to try and rebound quickly. And you know, if we can do that, I think, you know, we'll have some success. Because in Major League Soccer, consistency is key. You know, like in every league and in every sport. But, you know, I think furthermore, in this league, it's imperative that, you know, you can bounce back quickly. And you know, we'll hope to do that if we, you know, we get into some struggling periods of time during the season.
Speaking of experience, you're an MLS veteran now. And your first stint in the league was with Chicago Fire, I believe. How has your mindset changed from when you were a rookie in the league at a lower salary to a number one keeper in Toronto to now being a veteran player in Montreal?
My mindset's changed in a way. I think that I try and perform at a high level every day. You know, even in training. I think when you're a young kid coming out of university, you know, the atmosphere, the surroundings is different. It's an adjustment, and start to realize that, you know, you have to perform at the highest level as possible, and try and, you know, and do that as consistent as possible. And you know, that's what makes you become a better player and improve. And so, from that aspect, I think that I've tried to go into every training session with you know, trying to improve on certain aspects of my game and stay mentally and physically sharp. And I think it's benefited me as I've grown as a player, and you know, kept me in this game, you know, until today. And so, you know, it's a difficult thing to comprehend when you first come out of university, you know, with the longer season and you know, the struggles of travel, you know, and all those different factors that play into it. You know, it can be, you know, mentally tough, but you know, that's why you have some guys that come into this league for a year or two, and then, you know, they're finished, their career's over, because they just can't handle it physically and mentally. And so, you know, it's not easy, but it's, you know, it's part of the game, and that's what you have to be prepared for.
Greg, you played last year with the New York Red Bulls on a star-studded team headlined by Thierry Henry, and last July you were loaned to the Montreal Impact for the remainder of the season. Was it a tough choice to move back to the Division II level, and how much of that decision was predicated on wanting to be part of the Montreal Impact when the club moved up to the MLS this year?
It was a very big factor. You know, I had enjoyed my time in New York. You know, we had a good group of guys, and obviously a great city to live and play in. But when I was presented with this opportunity, you know, come back to Montreal, knowing that they would be moving into Major League Soccer the following year, you know, it was a decision that I made pretty easily. You know, knowing that I'd have the opportunity perhaps to move up to the you know, Major League Soccer with Montreal. So, it's always difficult when you go down to a lower division, and it's you know, play is not as, you know, quality play is not as, you know, as it was in Major League Soccer, you know, back last year. But, you know, it's something you have to get through. And like I said, there was a bigger goal at the end, and that was to, you know, make the roster for this year. And, you know, fortunate enough, I was able to do that. So, you know, I think it played out well, and I'm happy that the decision that I made with that option of coming up here, and like I said, it worked out in my favor.
Greg, you were recently quoted in an interesting article on Sportsnet.ca, which you discussed both your own battle with returning from a concussion and Sidney Crosby's fight to returning to the NHL following a number of concussions. It's a big issue in hockey right now, and I'm curious whether you feel the issue is something that needs to be taken more seriously in the soccer world.
Yeah, it's ironic, you know, we're having this conversation today about, you know, about Sidney Crosby, who was able to get on the ice last night, and he looked good, which is great for hockey, and great to see for his own personal well-being. Hopefully he'll be, you know, hopefully he'll be okay and he won't have another setback. But it's become a very important issue in sports, and I think it's, you know, it's a very difficult injury to diagnose, you know, because everybody's different, and the doctors and medical personnel, it's very difficult for them to understand that, to what degree these guys are suffering these concussions. And it really comes down to, you know, the player and being honest with the medical staff on how they feel and engaging their symptoms. And that's a very difficult thing. I had trouble with it when I had my concussion back in 2007. I mean, I came back when I shouldn't have come back, and I should have listened to my body a little more, and I didn't. I paid for it tenfold. So, you know, I think the awareness now you're starting to see is good. I think it can get even better, you know, especially now in hockey. I mean, it's such a prominent injury, and you know, I think the awareness is coming around. And, you know, that's important, you know, from a hockey standpoint, but also from a general, you know, general well-being standpoint of people's health. So it's an injury, you know, that I think professional players in all sports need to be be more educated on. I still don't think that there's enough education, to grasp the concept of, what this injury can really do to your body and your mind. And so I think once we start educating guys more and hopefully decreasing the amount of hits to the head in hockey, that's obviously a major issue. But it seems like they're cracking down on that. And, look, it's going to happen in sports. It's happened for years, but now we've just become more aware of it, and that's the important part of it. And hopefully we can decrease these longer stints where guys get sidelined for months. And hopefully we can just keep it to weeks and we'll not have any long-term damage.
Greg, following on that last question, there can be, a lot of contact in the box and situations where a keeper is quite exposed. Probably much more so than other positions. So, outside of the struggle and the frustration of just dealing with a concussion physically, was it hard for you psychologically to come back after you suffered your concussion?
I think personally for me, the first training session that I came back from when I had been out for so long, that was the most difficult part of it. It's just trying to gauge whether or not I was okay. Again, trying to be honest with myself. But after that, I just kind of put it to the side, and I just went about my business. There's days today when I stand in front of these guys that are blasting, 80 mile per hour shots on net, and it's just whizzing by my ears, and I'm thinking to myself, man, if that hit me in the head, where would I be right now? But that's the choice I've made to continue playing, and last year was I had another concussion last year early in the season with New York after the first game in a training session, and I was smart about it. I took my time coming back, and fortunate enough for me, I was only out for 3 weeks, and I was back on the field, and I felt fine. So that was as much as it's bad. Funny as it sounds, that was a good feeling to be able to come back from a concussion after only, being out 2-3 weeks compared to being out 6 months. So, that's part of the sport, and that's part of my position that you have to deal with, but you can't really let it affect you, because I think it's just going to affect my game, and, I don't want that to happen. I live by the motto, what's meant to be is meant to be, and whatever happens, happens. There's things I can control, and there's things I can't. I obviously just try and do the things I can control. Just kind of go from there.
Greg, looking at the international level now, how did you end up playing for Canada? And the second question is, we both know Mike Toshek, Montreal Impact days. How did Mike Toshek find you, and how important was he to your career?
It was funny how I began playing with Canada. I started at a university. I was attending St. Lawrence University down in New York, which is upstate New York, not far from Cornwall. And at that time, Mike Toshak was the goalkeeper coach down there. And he had asked me, knowing that I was Canadian, that I ever participated with any of the youth teams. And I told him no, because I grew up in the States, but it was really never associated with any of the under 20 teams or under 17 or any youth teams. So when he found out that I was eligible to play for Canada still, that it was during the Olympic trials with the under 23 team, and went up to Toronto and had a session with our good friend Bruce Twomley and Kevin Muldoon and company, and was able to earn a roster spot on that team, and through Mike I was got introduced to Canada, which was great, because it obviously led to the national program and still part of that pool today. So, Mike's had a good influence on my career, and I'd like to think I have had a good influence on his career. When I joined my team to Montreal, or my second year, I believe it was in Montreal, I brought Mike up to Montreal, and so, introduced him to the program. So kind of scratched each other's back, and it's worked out for both of us.
Greg, Canadian national team head coach Stephen Hart has always maintained that playing regular minutes at the club level is one of his main qualifiers in terms of the players he calls up to the national team. Montreal has two very experienced MLS keepers in yourself and Donovan Ricketts. Is playing for Canada something that is top of mind for you right now, And given that you were in a similar situation with Buna Kundil last year in New York, how are you approaching the battle for a starting position, you know, or minutes in Montreal?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously, you know, playing for a national team, anytime you have the opportunity, is something I relish and you know, would love to continue to play with them. And you know, I think it's in our situation as a goalkeeper, you know, I think it's important that you're playing on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. But at the same time, when you've got, you know, a guy, like, for example, for myself, a guy who's been around long enough and know how to, you know, keep myself in you know, a good frame of mind and keep sharp, you know, I think I can still contribute even if I'm not playing on a weekly basis with my club team, you know, for the national team. But having said that, obviously, you know, you want to be playing on a weekly basis. And so approaching it, you know, this year with Montreal, I'm going into training, you know, pushing myself and Donovan and Evan Bush. And, you know, we've got a good relationship, the three of us. I think all three of us are good quality keepers. And, you know, we're going to continue to push each other, which will, you know, hopefully bring out the best in everybody. But, you know, it's something, again, it's something I can't control on, you know, who he puts out on the field. You know, I can control how I perform, and that's what I've been trying to do. And I feel good. I feel the last few years I felt you know, that my experience is really has been key to my game, and from a physical standpoint, I feel strong and sharp as ever. And so, you know, I know I've got lots to give left in this game, and you know, I hope to do that.
Greg, Canada's current goalkeeping situation seems to have a strong group of goalkeepers. Looking at the other keepers in the Canadian national team pool, who do you think should be the number one keeper for Canada right now?
Other than myself?
Yes.
But you have a spot. Yeah, sure, why not? I'll respond to that question. I think that, you know, if you look in the past, you know, games, we've had some different guys come in and play. Lars Hirschfeld has done fairly well when he's come in and played, and so you know, he's probably out of the pool that we have. He's the more experienced Caps player, but you know, from a club standpoint, I think you know, he's probably played just as many games as I played in the club standpoint. So you know, it's something that it's a tough decision to make as a coach, but again, I think you just have to, you know, go with the guy you're confident in, and you know that can get the job done. And, you know, I think we've got you know, a young kid, and it's blank my mind now, but
Borjan.
Yeah, correct. Milan. So he's the, you know, he's a young kid that's going to come up. He's got some growing to do, and you know, as the goalkeeper, and, he's going to have to gain some experience through playing on a weekly basis, and I think he's trying to do that. He can find a consistent place to play. But yeah, I mean, I think we've got some quality in that position, like we do in all positions. It's just, you know, getting the guys to be playing at a high level when they come into camp.
All right, that was Greg Sutton of the Montreal Impact, and you know, speaking of the Montreal Impact, they played a pretty big game this weekend, Chris. Their home opener, and set a new record for attendance at a soccer match in Montreal. You know, what was your general impression of the proceedings?
Well, you said they set a record. It was almost 60,000, if I stand corrected. I believe it was almost 60,000. I think that is such an accomplishment for that organization. I've played in Montreal. I've played with the Impact. And I know the ownership in terms of Joey Saputo there. And I know how hard he works, and he believes in his brand, and how much he believes in the city there. So what an achievement, what an accomplishment to them for going out and you know, appealing to the fans and wanting and willing them to come out. And great kudos to them as well. They definitely, the fans gave that support, and you could see it in the first goal. I know we're going to get to that, but you could see it when the jubilation on the fan support when Davy Arnault scored that goal. So I think it was fantastic. And also from the standpoint, Stephen, you can give me your thoughts on this. How can you be apathetic in terms of, you know, from a media standpoint and from, you know, a general public, general fan support? You cannot ignore that type of atmosphere, that type of number in terms of almost 60,000 people at a game. I think that is fantastic to
Yeah, it was amazing, and you know, obviously, having that third team now, we've all been waiting for it and talking about it, and you know, there's Montreal's already got a good rivalry with Vancouver, and you know, there's the obvious fit of a rivalry with Toronto and Montreal, and also just the ramifications for player development in Quebec and growing the game in another region. You know, it's just fantastic, and you know, I do wish Montreal well this season. I hope they can you know, come through and be that Canadian team that you know, that doesn't finish at the bottom of the table and does well in their first year.
Yeah, I think they have their work cut out for them, but Jesse Marsh and crew, Nick DeSantis there, they definitely have a goal in mind. I know it's not to finish in the bottom at the bottom of the league. They don't want to be a laughingstock of the league, so they're going to do everything in their power to get that you know, get those wins under their belt and get some road victories as well, which will be difficult. I can't wait for that match in April, I believe it is, when they play TFC. I think that's going to be a fantastic rivalry. And you mentioned something in terms of player development. I believe that Montreal Impact, they have some things in place there that they have to get right, and I think they might just do that, and they will be a successful franchise. As I mentioned, Joey Saputo is only about success, so I think they'll get that right, and I wish them all the best this season.
So looking at the game on the pitch, you know, it was a fun game to watch. The first ever goal by the Montreal Impact by Davey Arnaud, you know, it was a nice goal. Sometimes you see the you know, the first goal is an own goal or something not very beautiful, but that one was quite pretty. So it's quite nice for them to go into the record book with you know, with a goal befitting of the level of soccer that's being played in Montreal now.
Yes, you know, as a Canadian, I want the Montreal Impact to beat Chicago there. You know, in the beginning moments of the game, I was thinking, you know, Montreal, they look a little bit sluggish, look a little bit slow. I don't know Jesse Marsh's lineup in terms of playing Arnaud out wide. I don't think that's his natural position. They were trying to move the ball, and they looked quite comfortable at times. I think Patrice Bernier does his job there. He slows down the counterattack when needed. He also, you know, he dictates the pace of the game throughout the midfield. And I think the Montreal Impact defense actually played a solid game, pretty solid game. I know the goal was disappointing for them to give up that leading goal. And I guess I can talk about it now. I think Niasse, he didn't close down that mid part of the field. And, you know, Grazzini, I believe I pronounced his name correctly there, he's Chicago Fire's most dangerous player. And he received the ball just on top of the box. And Josh Gardner didn't do himself any favors. He got caught napping. And he let Aduro get in behind him. And kudos to Aduro again to not give up on the play. And that was disappointing from the Montreal Impact standpoint. I think they played a pretty good game. The goal by Davey Arnaud and the celebration, you could see the jubilation on his face. It was fantastic. And what a moment. I think for everybody who's watching on TV, I mean, you can almost, you know, sink your teeth into that moment and say, wow, that's incredible, just the reaction there. So, again, that was fantastic from that standpoint.
Josh Gardner and Senan Niasse are a couple of interesting players. Gardner, just for the fact that, you know, almost a fairy tale ending there with that blast off the crossbar in injury time. If that had gone in, it really would have been, you know, just the most fantastic way for them to really launch their franchise at home. With Senan Niasse, you know, a bit of an enigma there, a player with incredible pace. You know, you can see that that pace definitely scares the opposition, but also some instances, and he deserves credit. He was the one who set up the goal by Arnaud. It was his cross, so that shouldn't be forgotten. But with Niasse, it looks like he's still learning the game in terms of his decision making. You know, I was starting to think of him as sort of the Theo Walcott of MLS. I'm just wondering what you think about Niasse. He's still a young player, and you know, he's developing now under a very knowledgeable coach in Jesse Marsh, who is known, you know, very much for being a very smart and competitive player. You know, do you think that, you know, Marsh is going to be able to, you know, turn Niasse into even more than he already is now?
Well, I think the easiest tactic that Jesse Marsh can do is placing Niasse out wide. I think that's his most dangerous position. I think, you know, with his back to goal as a striker, it's quite hard for him. Niasse's still a bit raw. He's finding out in terms of, you mentioned, his decision-making. He's finding his way. he's finding, you know, his craft in terms of, you know, what works best. And I think what works best is him running at defenders. It's similar to Ryan Johnson. If Ryan Johnson from Toronto sees facing players and he can run at them, he's going to be effective. And that's Niasse's game. And I played against Niasse, actually, and I know from playing against him, he is quite pacey, and you don't want him running at you with or without the ball. I think if he can threaten him behind the back line of MLS sides without the ball, they're going to be afraid. They're not going to want to push forward and give him that space. So Niasse and Jesse Marsh, that relationship, Jesse Marsh can definitely, you know, under his tutelage, he can definitely help Niasse to become a strong, consistent player in the MLS.
Well, you suggested on last week's podcast that Montreal was probably going to dip into the Italian market in terms of bringing in another attacking player for their squad. And they did just that. They didn't sign a DP, but they signed a pretty experienced player with international experience. And I'm wondering what you thought of the brief appearance as well as the potential of Montreal's new Italian striker.
Yeah, Karate there. I hope we didn't see too much of him. He definitely, from seeing him on TV, has great experience, and he's played a numerous amount of games in Syria and throughout Europe. So he Karate can be a presence. I hope that his legs are still with him, because the MLS travel isn't the easiest, and that once you go get on those road games, you have to be mentally prepared and physically able and capable to withstand that travel and that pressure. So hopefully Karate can be an asset to them. He definitely, in terms of his experience in the locker room, he can be a leader. You can see, you know, even I remember near the end of the game where there was a wall, there was a free kick, and he was, you know, speaking. It's good to see that. You know, once a leader, always a leader. So if he can bring that to Montreal, I believe at least that's something. I know they're probably looking for him to produce on the goal sheet. He needs to score goals for them, and I'm not too sure if that's their DP type player. I'm not sure if that they've announced him as a DP, but I think they're looking to him to produce. And at the bottom line is that he's from a pedigree that expectations are high. So hopefully he does well for them, and they get some wins early, and he can be a part of that in terms of scoring goals.
Well, the team has some challenging games ahead of them, and you know, we'll see what that brings. You know, with the draw, the first MLS point, and the goal, the first MLS goal, and getting that monkey off their back, how much confidence does that give the team, and does that ease the pressure now heading into game three?
Yeah, it's about self-belief, and you know, you go back to the locker room. Yes, they did not get that victory. It was a draw, but you know, it's that self-belief. They had it in their grasp, in their sights, and that you know, bodes well for them going forward, you know, as an organization, you know, from the crowd support. So yeah, the crowd support, you have the organization doing well in terms of that. You have the management level, you know, they feel like they have the right squad, the right lineup, and they get that goal, you know, they have that monkey off their back, and now they can move forward. They have a point, they're on the points board there, and they're not at the bottom, you know. So I think in terms of self-belief as a team in that locker room, it bodes well for them, and it should only get better. They have some tough games on the road, but it gives them that little bit of confidence, and they're not on the back foot. So again, wish Montreal Impact all the best.
Okay, moving on to the West Coast, you know, the final team that we're going to talk about on today's podcast is the Canadian team that is undefeated. The Vancouver Whitecaps are 2-0 to start the season, and you know, almost more importantly, their second win came on the road after you know, a 2011 season in which they went winless playing on the road. How big is it that they got that victory against Chivas, and that you know, they've already proven that they can grind out a win on the road?
I mean, we just spoke about it in terms of self-belief in the locker room, and the Vancouver Whitecaps, as you know, Steve, is my favorite team to speak about, and so that is a huge, absolutely huge win. And talk about monkey off your back. They went winless in 2011 season on the road, and now in 2012 they're second win in as many games. So that is huge for the team's psyche. Again, when I mentioned last week's podcast, when you have Eric Hassley, David Kimiento, players who are extremely talented, probably the most talented players in MLS, those types of players defending, running back for you, that just tells you something. And I remember, I think, my first appearance on Red Nation when I mentioned that Vancouver Whitecaps needed to get some pieces in place, and that piece is Martin Rennie. He has that team ticking over. You cannot just win games in the MLS based on talent. You need a self-belief. You need that will, that determination to win. And Martin Rennie seems to be instilling that in his players. And you know what? When a player believes in their coach, they will, you know, move, you know, heavens and earth for that coach, because he believes in them. It's a two-way street. And you can see it. You can see it in their play. And Jay DeMerida, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's his first goal with the Vancouver Whitecaps, Steve.
I believe it is. And it's interesting that Jay DeMerida got it. And, you know, going back to your comment with Ryan Johnson about, you know, needing a supporting cast to be successful, you know, we all know Jay DeMerritt has problems with injuries, and he had some games where, you know, he wasn't quite his best last season. You know, looking at Jay DeMerritt, it just seemed last year, you know, with the supporting cast on that back line not being as strong as it is this year, that he was trying to be Superman in every game trying to cover for all four spots on the back line. It looks like with the addition of Bonjour and young Pio Lee and Alain Rochat going back to his regular spot, that Jay DeMerritt can just be Jay DeMerritt, you know, a team leader, but also just, you know, one center back on a back line. You know, how much does he benefit from the offseason acquisitions that Vancouver has made?
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. Fantastic. I think that Jay DeMerritt, last season, he was isolated quite a bit, and it showed some of his weaknesses in his play, and obviously he dealt with some injuries, and he was faced with a lot of challenges throughout games. So I think with the additions, and again, Martin Rennie's brought in pieces, he's brought in leaders, and, you know, with Sebastian Letou, he's not a defender, but Sebastian Letou's a leader, young Pio Lee is a leader, Alain Rochat is in the back line, Bonjour, I'm sure he's a leader in terms of his center back skills, and what he brings to Vancouver's lineup. I think, you know, with Joe Cannon there, I think you have mature players. And again, when Peter Tordeson's regime there, it was hard because there was definitely discrepancies in the locker room. There was definitely a separation. And now you can see it in Jay DeMerritt's play. He's probably a lot more relaxed. The pressure's off of his shoulders because there are other leaders, players taking that weight off of his shoulders. And he can go out there and just do what he does best. And he comes through with a goal, clutch goal, and Vancouver gets their first road victory. So that is fantastic for them and fantastic for Jay DeMerritt. Gives him so much confidence. You know, again, he's injury-plagued, it seems, but hopefully the injuries are behind him and he can continue on being consistent.
Well, you know, a great start. It really couldn't go much better for Vancouver so far. You know, an opening game at home in which they beat Montreal and then picking up their first ever road victory. So, you know, they're obviously going to have to, you know, continue that through the rest of the season. But I think they have the depth and, as you said, even more importantly, the experience and the leadership, that I don't think they're going to have those stretches where they, you know, don't at least get a win or a draw, you know, over a number of games. They're not going to be a lot of long losing streaks for this team. You know, looking at what you've seen thus far and taking into account the fact that, you know, they're still gelling and putting things together with a new head coach and with a bunch of new faces on the team. You know, do you like what you've seen so far from the Vancouver Whitecaps?
Yeah, I love what I see from the Vancouver Whitecaps. They're maybe one of the most exciting teams, actually, they are, in terms of their attacking threats and attacking options. So I love what I see from them. Again, I was critical of the Vancouver Whitecaps in terms of my first podcast with Red Nation, and it was just because I think Martin Rennie, he has those pieces in place, like I mentioned. And in terms of the locker room, once you get that right, in terms of a coach, in terms of an organization, you can do so many great things. And I see the Vancouver Whitecaps being successful this season. I'm not going to predict that they're going to win the MLS title. I will predict that they will make the playoffs, though. As you mentioned, they won't have those long losing streaks that they had last season. I think that they have their bases covered in terms of what they're trying to do moving forward this season and the years to come. It's great to see some of the players that I played with while I was there. And you can even see, look at Gershon Kolfi, and Watson got in this game. I think Matt Watson started. So you can see with players like that, there's competition. And once Martin Rennie gets that locker room right, I think Vancouver can be very successful. And I wish them all the best. Another Canadian side that has so much looking forward to. So, I think they've done some great things there with adding Martin Rennie and his staff. So, again, wish them all the best.
Yeah, I wish them all the best as well. It's exciting. And, you know, it's going to make for a very exciting, I was going to call it the Nutrilite Canadian Championship, but I think it's called the Amway Canadian Championship this year. So it's going to make for a very, very exciting Canadian Championship tournament. you know, just how much they've upgraded. You know, TFC have certainly, with the win against Los Angeles, proven that they can compete, you know, at that level and playing in CONCACAF games now. So, you know, with all due respect to Montreal and FC Edmonton, I can't wait to see those games between TFC and Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Should be a fierce rivalry, and in years to come, it will be something to see. It'll be a great spectacle to watch.
All right. Well, we've gone through all three Canadian teams on this podcast, and you know, a lot of good things happening in all three MLS cities. We're going to close off this podcast with something different from last week. One of Red Nation's contributors, Gavin Day, was in Cyprus, you know, a couple of weeks ago, covering both the Canadian women's national team and the Canadian men's national team. And we're going to end off this episode of North of 49 by running an interview that I did with him, in which we got his thoughts on, you know, both covering the men's team for that friendly against Armenia, and also the considerable amount of time that he spent covering the women's national team at the Cyprus Cup. So, you know, with that said, thanks for listening this week. And, you know, here's Gavin Day talking about our Canadian national teams. All right, I'm here with Gavin Day, who is just back in Toronto from a pretty unique trip, in the sense that I believe he was the only journalist in Cyprus covering both the women's Canadian national team and the men's Canadian national team for their friendly against Armenia. Gavin, how are you doing?
Not too bad. How about you, Steve?
Good. Are you, you know, past the jet lag and, you know, back on Toronto time?
Yeah, it didn't take too long. It always, whenever you sort of travel west, I find the jet lag isn't as bad as when you're heading east. But it was in terms of that, I survived pretty well. But, you know, going to have to get used to Central time. It's almost time to head out to Nashville next week.
Alrighty. Yeah, and, you know, you were over there covering both the men and the women for Red Nation and a number of other sources, including the CBC. And, you know, that's a pretty unique experience to have both teams, you know, basically in the same location, you know, right during the same time period. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, they say you can't really compare those two teams in terms of competing at the international level, but talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, the mood around the women's team and the mood around the men's team. You know, at this point in time, the women are sort of coming off a World Cup in which they didn't do as well as everyone had hoped, and the men are trying to get back to a World Cup for the first time since 1986.
Yeah, I mean, with the women's team, they've rebounded so well in terms of attitude. I don't know if it's just because of John Herdman or if it's just the nature of the group, but, you know, they have a lot of fun together. They joke around, and it's, you get a very good feeling of they enjoy each other's company. With the men, you know, it was hard to really gauge them since they had just scrambled in. You know, some had just gotten in not long beforehand, and they get a training session and a half where it's almost, you know, hi, good to see you, how are the kids, and then they're gone again. So, I mean, it's obviously different natures. The women's team do get to get so much more time together, whereas the men, you know, in the nature of these friendlies, they don't really get much time together, so the chemistries are different. But you know, I can imagine the group with the men this summer, given they'll have a bit more time together around the U.S. friendly and the World Cup qualifying games, that, you know, it'll be a bit more loosey goosey after a couple days as well.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at that men's team, just a question there. You know, we all were able to watch that Armenia friendly. You know, it didn't quite, you know, at least have the result come out the way we wanted to. And we know there were challenging circumstances, you know, leading up to that game in terms of both preparation time and, you know, players being released like at the last possible second and whatnot. You know, being on the ground there, you know, and one of the few people actually watching the game, you know, from the press box there in a neutral environment, what's the main thing that you took from that game from Canada's perspective?
It was hard to sort of get anything out of it. I mean, I even asking Stephen Hart before the game, I said, what do they get out of these training sessions? And he says, nothing. It's all in the game, and it's up to them to put something together. And, you know, it was hard to. Samuel Piet, the youngster
Hoyer on the team, his agent, who also coincidentally doubles as the agent for Junior Hoylett, described it as the game as players playing not to get injured for their club teams. And it, frankly, it looks like that. You know, and I don't blame them at all for flying to Cyprus from wherever you are in Europe for two training sessions before a game in the rain and wind in pretty miserable conditions in Cyprus. I can understand how their clubs would be a little bit hesitant to let them go. And, you know, they probably looked as if they were sort of playing with the handbrake on and didn't want to risk anything, didn't want to risk injury, given the nature that it is just a friendly.
Just as an aside there, were you able to gain any particular revelation from Junior Hoylett's agent while you were face-to-face with him?
Well, I didn't actually speak to him in person. It was just all a matter of hearsay. He did say some interesting things. First of all, from a professional standpoint, I did hear that Hoylett has had some interest from some pretty big Premier League clubs, those being Arsenal, Tottenham Hotspur, and Liverpool. And second, just heard it through the grapevine that Hoylett is really wanting to play for Canada, but there are some familial obstacles in that. So some family members would rather he play for Jamaica.
So looking at the Canadian team, you know, you've been on site for pretty much all of Canada's games over the last couple of years, and now we're really heading to sort of crunch time with the next round of qualifiers against some pretty considerable opponents. You know, from your standpoint and your viewpoint, what are your main concerns for Canada heading into those games against Cuba, Honduras, and Panama?
I'm going to be especially interested to see how the players, especially the European-based players, come in after a long, long season in Europe. I mean, there's been obviously drama and transfers with the likes of Josh Simpson, who had some issues with his Turkish club, but fortunately now found a home in Switzerland. Or a guy like Milan Borjan, who wasn't playing in Romania and then needed to be wasn't playing in Turkey and needed to be loaned out to Romania. So it's going to be interesting to see what sort of mental state these guys are in after a long and draining season. Second, I mean, this is what Stephen Hart was hired for. This round, this semifinal round, is where Canada has been tripped up the last couple times. And so, you know, forget about the Gold Cup results, forget about this, forget about everything else. This is what will define, ultimately, Stephen Hart's coaching reign. And, we'll see how he plans for that. And, that's what's going to be the big thing.
So moving on to the women's team, you spent a considerable amount of time with John Herdman and the rest of the women's national team, and as you mentioned, they have bounced back well, both in terms of their performances and in terms of just the positivity around the team as a whole. At the same time, in the Cyprus Cup final, they did lose once again to France, who we all know dealt them that blow at the last World Cup. So what was the mood like among the team after that loss to France?
They were still rather upbeat. This is all they sort of talk about the plans for the Olympics as visualizing the end result, and that's winning a gold medal or being on the podium, and what needs to happen every day until that point. So I think they've taken it really well in stride. They allowed me to ride the bus with them back to their hotel, and it was a quiet bus, obviously, but this is a step on the road. John Herdman, the coach, he mentioned after the game that there is a bit of a gap that has developed between France and Canada, and I think France, a lot of that can be chalked up to the fact that most of the women on the French team play for the same club side in Lyon. So they know each other, they know where they're going to be, they know, you know, timing of runs and so on. But, you know, given that Canada will have a lot of time together, playing against some tough opponents, they have some friendlies lined up against some top opponents, and they have that residency camp, you know, hopefully some of that familiarity will come into the Canadian side, and they'll be able to develop something of a sixth sense with each other on the field.
Now, we're early into the John Herdman era, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your perception of the team and maybe the difference in the atmosphere around the Canadian team under Herdman as opposed to, you know, the mood and the atmosphere around the team under Carolina Marracci, who had a very different personality from John Herdman?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the players will say it personally, but I don't know really how well they got along with Marracci. They seem to enjoy the ease of everything that Herdman brings to the table, whereas I think Marracci was a bit more of an authoritarian sort of figure. You know, I spoke with Christine Sinclair, and I asked her about the camp in Rome that they had prior to the World Cup that she didn't join in, and she is going to join in the residency this time around for the Olympics. And she sort of explained that, first of all, she was signed to a pro team, so she couldn't go anyway, but that the coaching staff under Marracci didn't really appreciate that, you know, playing professionally and playing at a high level is important. They felt she should have been in camp. Whereas Herdman is a lot more understanding, a lot more appreciative of players finding their own way and playing in other countries at the top, at the highest level.
So one final question for you today. I guess the million-dollar question for the Canadian team at this point is, you know, they've looked good, even dominant at times, against certain teams and certain competition. But do you think this team has another gear under John Herdman, you know, to be able to legitimately compete with France and the U.S.?
You know, it's hard to gauge that. I mean, it has been. We are a few months into the John Herdman era. He's had a Pan American Games with the group. He's had an Olympic qualifying, and now he's had a Cyprus Cup. So he's said that in this residency, it's going to be players who realistically have a chance of making the anyone who you know, who is on the fence with that. It's going to be just drilling those players who likely will be at the Olympics. And I think now that there is the familiarity between Herdman and the players, that, you know, it's time to develop that relationship. And I think not so much there's another gear, just the familiarity and understanding between what the coach expects and the players actually performing that is going to be developed. And I think, you know, the players come Olympics will know what's expected of them, will know their roles, will know what they want positionally, set pieces, all that stuff. So I think, you know, it's going to be a bit more of a polished result than what we've seen in the first few months under Herdman.
All right, well, we'll see what the rest of 2012 brings for our Canadian national teams. You know, you're going to be our Canadian national team correspondent for both the men and the women on the North of 49 podcast. And so we'll talk to you again soon and get your insight again. Thanks very much, Gavin.
Thank you. This is going to be a very big year for Canadian teams.
Thank you for listening to the North of 49 podcast. We're interested in your feedback. If you have comments or a suggestion for a topic that you'd like covered on the podcast, please email us at steveb@rednationonline.ca.